as a teacher you begin with, and then you kind of find this path into the mental game, the psychology of the game. How did that happen? How did you find your way into this, what you do?
It was kind of my own failures, really, Walter. I mean, I left school. I'd had a sort of really good start to my playing days in the sense that I took up the game relatively late. I was 15 when I started to play. And within less than 2 years, I actually shot level par in a tournament. I'd never had any lessons. And after that shooting level par, somebody said to me that, "Oh, all this progress that you've made, you know, you need you, if you took some lessons, you'll really improve." And that was kind of like the downward spiral in a way from a playing perspective, that I went in search of this theoretically perfect golf swing. I actually turned professional, started to focus mainly on coaching, and was heading down the same route really. And it was a conversation that I had with Fred Shoemaker many, many years ago. And he said to me, he said, "Be very careful that you don't pass on to others what didn't work for you." And that really hit home for me, because I thought, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm just giving more and more technical information to people, seeing them improve maybe on the range, but then not transferring to the golf course. And I actually left golf for a while. I actually left golf for a couple of years, and went away and studied and looked at all kinds of disciplines like NLP and hypnosis, cognitive behavioral therapy, lots of different things in a game. And then after a few years came back and started to coach, but coach more the performance side of things. And I actually got very lucky with a player in my region in the northwest of England, a guy called Philip Archer, who a nickname called the Pro-Am King, whereby he'd shoot ridiculously low scores in pro-ams, but could never transfer it into four-round tournaments. Anyway, long story short, we did some work, and he went to the European Tour, as it was then, DP World Tour, now Tour School, that year, and he shot 27 under par, and finished second in the Tour School, and got his card, and had a very successful few years after that. Made the Rolex Cup team, and Neil, but for Brett Rumford chipping in, and Kron Cercieri would have won the European Masters. But anyway, that led to working with other players like Graham McDowell, Darren Clarke, Lee Westwood, Paul McGinley, Charles Schwartzel, Louis Oosthuizen. So I was very lucky, really, and it was right time and right place, really. But I think looking back on it, the failures that I ha had as a player have actually helped me relate to players when I've been working with them, in the sense that it's not just come from a purely academic background, it's come from a personal experience of the game. And you know, whilst I never played at the very highest level, I do understand the game, and sort of narrowed it down eventually to two key things if you're trying to get better at golf. And those two key things would be, you've got to develop skill. And anybody who says that the game is all in the mind is talking nonsense. You know, you need to develop some golfing skills, but then you need to be able to access those skills. And what most people are doing, they're perhaps developing some skills, but they can't access those skills on the course. And then all they do is they work on more skills, and it's like a vicious cycle that they go through. So probably a long answer to a good question. That's about where it was from.
It leads me to my next question. I don't know if you saw it. I think this was on Saturday, or no, it was Friday after the second round of the US Open. Harry Higgs, who was, I think, the 156th person to qualify for the US Open, he had a press conference after his round. He had a fantastic round, and he was incredibly open about all the psychological machinations going on in his head throughout this round, which is a good round. And it was a bit shocking to hear, you know, this guy who's, yeah, he was 156th guy to qualify, but he's been a tour pro for a long time. He's had a fair level of success, and how he talked to himself on the course, and how he berated himself, and how his whole approach, at least through Friday, was to be kind to himself. And it just got me thinking about, you know, even for us, for those of us amateur players, I talk to myself worse on the golf course than anywhere else. And I always question that. I wonder, why do I berate myself? Here's Harry Higgs, one of the top players, 150 top players in the world. Is it shocking to you that this type of kind of dialogue goes on in our brains, at least when we're on the golf course?
No, it's not shocking at all, Walter, because I've heard it for 35 years now when I've talked to players at every level, including the top players. You know, we watch these guys on TV and we often think they're walking around the golf course in a Buddha-like state, but it couldn't be farther from the truth a lot of times. And I think we need to understand what our brain is up to at a kind of deeper level. And this might be sort of complicated this, but I'll try and make it as simplistic as possible so it's useful. Is that our brain really, first and foremost, is not concerned when you go out on the golf course with whether you play good golf or not. Your brain is still primarily concerned with survival. It's wired into us, it's hardwired into us, a primeval instinct to survive. And one of the things that we had to do to survive when we roamed around in caves was to be a part, a valuable member of a group. We had to stay a part of the, because if we were ostracized from a group, it meant one thing, and that was death. Now, obviously things are very different now, but our brain often sees things in the same way. Now, the group that we are in, the group that you and I are in, are a group called golfers. And we go out there, and our perceived value within that group, the brain really sort of homes in on that and actually starts, if we're not careful, to see the golf course as a really threatening environment. And when it's in a threatening environment, it generates lots and lots of thoughts. So I think one of the key things is, and it's counterintuitive, this is to realize what your brain is up to. And your brain essentially is trying to look after you, it's trying to protect you. And a lot of people are actually at war with the brain. They don't like all these thoughts. They don't like all these things going on in their head. They don't like all these sensations that we get. But when you realize what your brain is up to, it doesn't necessarily stop the thoughts coming. That's a fool's errand. But what you can do is you can notice the thoughts and have a different relationship to the thoughts. I know when I'm working with a player, a top-class player that we're getting somewhere. When that player starts to take their thoughts less seriously, in the sense that we tend to believe that voice that says you're going to miss this, or you're going to knock it out of bounds, or you're going to three putt or whatever. And yet everybody listening to this podcast also will have hit shots when they felt uncomfortable. They will have hit good shots when they felt bad, and they will have hit bad shots when they felt good. So the idea that we have to be in a perfect state to play good golf is a bit of a nonsense, really. It's understanding a little bit more about your brain. It's understanding what it's up to, kind of making friends with it, really, and realizing the key to it all is the skill of attention. Is, you know, even though the brain might be sort of sending lots of different thoughts around, do you have the skill to bring your attention back to this putt, this drive, this tee shot, this bunker shot? And putting your attention in a place that's useful to you. Focus. There was a guy on my podcast a while ago, and he came out with a great phrase, and he said that attention is the currency of performance. And I've never heard it put better than that. And I think, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to develop skills in terms of shots and, you know, short game and things like that. But I think if everybody maybe just gave a little bit of consideration, could you spend the next few months developing some attention skills, getting better at putting your attention where you want it to be, as opposed to where it ends up being as a result of a mind trying to protect you from perceived danger.
So you've had the unique, I guess, fortune of being involved with some life-changing experiences for people that you've worked with. You mentioned Darren Clark. Louis Oosthuizen's another person, and I saw an interview with him from back in the day before he won, or at the, I think it was right after he won the Open Championship, and he talked about the red dot on his glove. Can you explain what you and Louis worked on and the significance of putting a red dot on his glove?
It's hard to believe that coming up next few weeks, the Open will be at Birkdale, and it'll be 16 years since Louis won that Open. And I don't know, I've got the glove in the office. I carry it around most places with me because after that Open, he actually signed his glove that he wore on that final round with the red dot on it. Anyway, the upshot of it was, Walter, that the red dot was exactly what we've just talked about. It was about attention. Because I'd started working with Louis previous to that Open a few weeks. Now, he'd never actually made a cut in a major championship up to that point. I mean, a very talented player, won in Europe, great golf swing. And he played in the US Open a few weeks prior to the British Open. And we sat down and he said, "I'm really having trouble focusing on shots." He said, I'll get over the shot." And he said, "So often I'll hit the shot and I just wasn't there. I just wasn't there with the shot. I just wasn't present with the shot." And I said to him, "Well, what are you doing in between shots?" He said, "I'm focused in between shots." And I thought, "Oh, bingo, here we go." And we opened up a whole discussion about being able to kind of switch on and off. And anyway, the red dot became what we did was a deal whereby, and there was a glove in the office that day in Manchester, and he put this red dot on his glove. And the deal was that he would go from there, and every shot he would look at the dot on his glove. And that dot was a trigger to focus his attention on a couple of questions, a couple of questions around the shot at hand. So in effect, it was an attentional trigger to get him into the moment on each shot. And I think he shot 64 the first round at St Andrews. And quite a few people said, "Oh, it's nice that a young player's done well, but there's no way he's going to hang on for four rounds." And 3 days later, he's walking up the final hole at St Andrews. And if there's ever anywhere you'd want to walk up the final hole with a seven-shot lead, it's probably St Andrews, where you've got this big wide open fairway you can blast it left. And yeah, he walked up the hole, parred it, and won the British Open by 7 shots.
So you mentioned the idea that it's been 16 years since he won, and for those of us who've played golf for a long time, you've been in the business a long time, things kind of change, right? Your perspective changes, obviously, and you have this more experiences to draw from. But on from a golfer's perspective, I've noticed that I have a lot of more I guess struggles to draw from, right? Bad experiences, shocking things that have happened and whatnot. How does the mental game change as we age?
I think if somebody asked me, what would be the two mental game tools or skills or attributes, if you could give that to somebody, what would they be? One would be the skill of acceptance, a willingness to embrace the variety of outcomes that every round of golf gives you. That doesn't mean that you enjoy bad shots. It doesn't mean to say that you're happy with high scores, but a willingness to deal with that. But I would say the other skill, and maybe it's more relevant for those of us, past a certain age, as I'm sure we are, is the skill of gratitude. And it can sound a little bit tree huggy and a bit left field, but there was a guy called Richard Bandler many years ago. He said to me, he said, "The greatest delusion that human beings have is they think there will always be another chance. They'll think there is always going to be another week, another opportunity, another year." And without it sounding too sort of negative and maudlin, the one thing that we're all going to run out of is time and opportunity. And we don't know when that final round's going to come along, but there's almost an arrogance if we don't realize that it's finite. And then you start to look at gratitude, and to play the game as a foundation from a place of gratitude. I mentioned previously about the brain perceiving threat when you go on the golf course. One of the great antidotes to threat is gratitude. If you can deeply appreciate the fact that the next time that you play, think of all the things that have to conspire for you to play the next round of golf. You've got to be healthy enough. You've got to be, have the wherewithal financially to do it. There's got to be a lot of preparation in the golf course, the people that you're playing with, and all the rest of it. The point being that there's a very beneficial cascade of chemicals released when we're in a state of gratitude before we play. And I talk about going first in the sense that, most of my golfing life, I played under the delusion that if I played good golf, it would make me happy. And most of the time, I was waiting for that. Whereas if we actually decide that I'm going to be happy the fact that I get to play golf, and I'm saying this is not ridiculous false positivity, it's an understanding that every one of us will run out of rounds of golf to play. And there's a story that we had that a lot of people really resonated with in one of the books that we wrote, and it was called The Tuesday Boys. And it was an experience that I'd had, It was a few years ago. There were some issues going on in my life. My mother was very ill. She would have dementia and Alzheimer's and all the rest of it, which many people have gone through. It's a horrible experience. Anyway, I was out on the golf course early one morning. I was doing a pro-am, and I got up. It was a beautiful spring morning in the UK, where there was starting to be some heat in the sun, and the course was coming alive again after the winter. And I was walking on the course, and I walked past the tee. And as I walked past this tee, something made me come back to the tee. And on golf course, I'm sure it's the same in the States, that if you've been anybody of any note at a golf club, when you pass away, you become a bench. You get a bench somewhere on the golf course in memoriam to what you've done. Anyway, I saw this bench, and on this bench there was a plaque, and it said to the Tuesday Boys. Obviously, you don't need to be a Columbo to work out these guys would have played golf every day, every Tuesday, week after week, month after month, year after year. But what was very poignant, Walter, was that these guys, that every one of them that was listed under the Tuesday Boys, there was a birth date and there was a date when they'd passed away. And it really resonated with me that these guys would have turned up week after week, month after month, year after year, shot the breeze on the first tee, moaned about the golf and all the rest of it. But eventually, every single one of them ran out of Tuesdays. There were no more Tuesdays left. And we wrote about then so many people, it resonated with them, this idea of the Tuesday Boys, that we're all going to run out of Tuesdays or Thursdays or Fridays or whatever it is. And just this deep, deep appreciation and gratitude to be able to play the next time. But don't underestimate the power of playing from a state of gratitude before you play. You're actually doing your brain a world of good. And we even get people in the journals before they play just to write down a couple of things. What are you grateful for today? Because it's easy to take stuff for granted. Golf courses are some of the most beautiful terrain on earth, but we drive up the same drive, we get used to the same surroundings, and we take it for granted. And sometimes, people get a health issue and it jolts them out of it. But actually, I think for all of us, being in that state of gratitude is a really, really powerful thing to do. Is it going to stop you slicing it? No, but it's going to change your relationship to the game, which I think most people can end up with a, if they're not careful, they can end up making the thing that they love actually torture them.
So you just answered or provided an answer to my next question for you. So maybe you could come up with another one. But what lessons from golf apply directly to life? Obviously, gratitude, having a gratitude practice is a huge component and helps. Are there any other things that you've noticed over the years that you say, oh boy, if you can not only can apply this on the golf course, but apply this into life, you're going to be far ahead of the game.
I think golf's such a great metaphor. Well, it's not a metaphor, it's a reality, isn't it? It's so much life, so many things in life, whether it's in business or relationships or whatever. And one way of looking at it, so I think you could look at an individual golf shot, and in an individual golf shot, you can actually see the whole of life. Now that sounds a bit grandiose to say it, but bear with me. In the sense that when you come to play a golf shot, wherever that golf ball lies, the golf course is actually offering you a problem to solve. When you go out and play golf, depending on your ability levels, you've got between 65 and 100 separate puzzles to solve, separate problems to solve. The golf course is offering you a different puzzle on it each shot. And within that, then, when you start to go into the puzzle, and you look at the yardage and the lie and all the rest of it, all the data. The first thing is, if you have a clear intention of what you're actually trying to do, the question, what does a good shot look like here, is so profoundly important, because by having a clear intention, I intend this ball to do this, draw, fade, high, low, whatever it may be, go to this target, you're actually creating a map in your brain that it can allow your body to organize movement. Once you've created a clear intention, then you can focus your attention. So your attention may be on rhythm in your swing or the club head or whatever it is that you work on with your coach. A golf swing only takes 1.5 seconds, but in that 1.5 seconds, our attention can easily jump all over the place. So having your attention in one place is a real skill. And then whatever the ball does, there's going to be an outcome. Sometimes you'll hit good shots that have bad outcomes. Sometimes you'll hit bad shots that have good outcomes. There'll be a whole bunch of in between. But it's your willingness then to accept the reality of the outcome, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. And I think that carries over into almost everything in life, that you go into a situation, let's say it's a business meeting or a sales call or whatever. What is your intention? What do you intend to do in this interaction? Then once you know your intention, where do you need to focus your attention? Where does your attention need to be in the meeting or the conversation? But underpinning everything, I think, is this concept of acceptance that not all deals are going to go your way. Not all sales are going to come through. Not all relationships are going to work. Not all conversations end well. But if you, I think, cycle through that intention, attention, and acceptance cycle that you would on a golf shot, I think it's a pretty sound formula for a lot of things in life, really.
So I'd like to finish up my final question for you. I'll take this back to gratitude. And looking from the outsider's perspective, there's so much that I could look at your career in being involved with these major champions, helping change their lives, working with somebody like Philip Archer and making the impact you were able to make for him. What are you grateful for in your career? What stands out as being, boy, I'm so grateful I had this experience.
Yeah, I still often kind of pinch myself because I failed as a player, as I mentioned earlier on. But golf has been so incredibly kind to me. I've been to the Masters, I've been to the US Open, USPGA, many British Opens, and been in some wonderful places, and basically got paid for my hobby. But I think the thing that it still does, I'm 60 this year, I'm still interested and curious about learning. I love listening to other people. I like going to seminars. I've never been one of those people who thinks I know it all by any stretch. So I think, I've been playing golf now, as I said, from some 15 years of age to 60. It's a good number of years to be still curious about something. And I'll on my podcast, I'll get a guest on, and they'll say something, and I'll think, my goodness, I've never thought about that before. Just a one-off, we had John Mazenoble on the other day on my podcast. He's the CEO of Jumbo Max Grips. A really interesting guy, and we talked about non-tapered grips. And he said, well, in every other sport, tennis, baseball, squash, cricket, you don't have a tapered grip. It's a uniform grip, and they've created that. And this is a sales pitch for them that I didn't intend it to be, but and I thought that makes so much sense, and I'm intrigued to now try some non-tapered grips, which may or may not work for me. But I just thought, wow, after all those years, something like that, something that, I think there's a Moshe Feldenkrais talked about the elusive obvious, and it's a great phrase that's we can bury our head sometimes in looking at things in a certain way, and we sometimes we miss the obvious things that when you see them, you can never not see them.